Yeah. Yes, so let me give you an overview of the talk. There'll be 5 parts. First, what are super oscillations? How to make them? What are they good for and at what cost? And finally, what can we learn from their existence? Overall, this talk will start with something to do with foundations, because super oscillations arose out of the study of foundations. And then I will go into all sorts of applied things, and then eventually come back to foundational questions. So what are super oscillations? Super oscillations are functions that locally oscillate faster than their fastest Fourier component. So imagine a super oscillating function looking like this. This is, let's say, the time axis. And here we have the amplitude, t. Then a super oscillating function typically looks like this. And then fast oscillations, and then continues like that. Overall, you can arrange the super oscillating functions to be square integrable. So they would be eligible as quantum mechanical wave functions. So they decay fast enough to be square integrable. They don't have to, but you can make it this way. They have generally slow oscillations, interrupted by a period of really fast oscillations. And the point about super oscillations is that if you Fourier transform one of those super oscillatory wave functions or functions, then you find that they're strictly band limited. They have only low frequencies in them. These high frequencies don't actually show up in the Fourier transform. That's curious, because if you did a windowed Fourier transform just of this part of the function, then yes, you would see high frequencies. And you would see a high frequency exactly at that level that you see here, these high frequencies. And yet, if you Fourier transform the entire signal, the entire function over the real line, then there are no high frequencies in there.
Does it have to be of an infinite extent?
No. Actually, in my work with my many collaborators here, with Daphne Shark and with Eugene Tang, we also looked at super oscillations on an interval. You can do this. So if you do the Fourier transform over the entire signal, be that an interval itself or the entire real line, no high frequencies show up. But in the window, you see high frequencies. Now this means also that there must be high frequencies, in fact, as much as in there, also outside, right? Because the Fourier integral is linear. It consists of that windowed integral and the integral over the rest. So therefore, whatever high frequencies you have in here must also be present outside. Now, how can that be? You don't see high frequencies in there. Where are they? Now, it turns out that the solution to this to this question, the answer to that question, arises from a general phenomenon of Fourier theory, which is in fact behind the Hawking effect, the Under effect, and many other important effects. Imagine you have a waveform generator which produces a sine wave, and here we have it. And let's say that it has been running forever, and now you grab hold of the knob and you turn it to a higher frequency slowly. So this thing will now, because you're turning the knob, start to oscillate faster. Okay, and then it will go on oscillating that fast forever. So there's a transitional period where the frequency increased, and then it's constant again. What does the Fourier transform of that function look like? Well, let's see. I'm only plotting the positive frequency axis, because it's a real valued function, you get the same thing on the negative part. So let's say here we have frequency omega 1, and here we have frequency omega 2, and here we have the transition period in which we cranked up the knob. So what we would expect, of course, is that the Fourier transform of that signal has a peak at omega 1, because after all, it has been running at that frequency for half an eternity. And then we expect another peak at omega 2. So this is omega 1, this is omega 2. We would expect there to be a peak. And then maybe because of the transitional period where we cranked up the frequency, you would expect that there is a peak at omega 1, and then some stuff in between, and then a peak at omega 2 again. It looks roughly like this, not exactly. It actually has some oscillations in there, and it continues like this. It goes like this. In fact, it goes like this. The reason why there's Hawking radiation, the reason why there's Unruh radiation, is mathematically traceable to the fact that this has a tail all the way to frequencies of the other signature. I wrote a paper on that in the Unruh effect, but I don't think that in principle it's new. I mean, you just have to look at the equations to see this happening. But the point I want to make here is that even though with the frequency generator we only intended to make frequencies between omega 1 and omega 2, we ended up creating frequencies all over the place. And that's what's going on over here with super oscillations. We have fast oscillations in here, and we have just as much high frequency content in the complement of the real line, but it arises not because of actual fast oscillations. It arises because these slow oscillations change their frequency in a very slow, imperceptible way, but they do. And that is what produces the same amount of high frequencies as in here, just with the opposite sign, so that the total integral over this part and the complement doesn't show any high frequencies at all. Now you might wonder, this is probably very hard to create. Might be a possibility in theory, but is it possible to create functions like that? Now this is the view in hindsight. Super oscillations originated very differently. They originated in the 1990s in papers by Yakir Aronov, Michael Berry, and others. And Neil just told me today that apparently Sandu Popescu encountered them already in his PhD thesis, but didn't bother to write anything up about it. It's my own fault. Anyway, now Yakir Aronov and Michael Berry and others are credited for that. Now, when they first observed super oscillations, they thought this might be a numerical artifact. So they tried to increase the numerical accuracy, and they found, it's still true. The function is band limited, but it seems to have frequencies in it locally that are faster than what the bandwidth would indicate is possible. And then I found a way to construct super oscillatory wave functions explicitly, so that numerics was no longer necessary. You can really see that you can do it. However, the method to generate these super oscillating wave functions was unstable. It was numerically unstable. You can write it down, but in practice, you would have to invert a matrix that is what is called ill-conditioned, which means that the ratio of the largest and the smallest eigenvalues is tremendous. And that means that to invert that matrix is numerically highly unstable. You would not be able to calculate a super oscillating wave function with more oscillations than about 15 or so. And then you would need so many digits of accuracy to calculate the inverse of the matrix that it can't be done. And then there has been much more work on this, and also by myself and my group, several constructions, unfortunately mostly unstable constructions, numerically unstable. And then with a PSI student here at PI, Lali Hoinaki, well, she came up with the first numerically stable method to make super oscillations. It's so stable, you can make a million oscillations now. You don't have to invert any matrix for this, and I will review how that works. So it was a method, or it is a method, that allows you to make as many super oscillations as you want. You don't have full control, though, over it. in the sense that you can guarantee like a million zero crossings if that's what you want. So therefore you must have so many oscillations in here, but you can't prescribe exactly what the shape of the function should be. This is where another student of mine comes in, Barbara Schroeder, who just started this term. And she came up with the best method so far. It is a stable method for creating superoscillations, and it allows you to choose the function to do whatever it is you want it to do with arbitrary accuracy, and the method will generate for you what the rest of the signal should look like, that whatever high frequencies might be in here are canceled by the rest. So that's a result that's just over a month old. Now, in hindsight, looking back, it turns out that there were theoretical and experimental hints at the existence of superoscillations before the 1990s. There was Landau, not the physicist Landau, the information theorist and mathematician Landau, who was playing with prolate spheroidal functions, who, it turns out, in a certain limit, are superoscillatory. And also, people who work in optics had noticed that sometimes there are oscillations that are faster than one might expect on the basis of the bandwidth. So the field has some back history there. Okay, so how to construct superoscillations? Here is the first numerically stable method, the one that goes back to the PSI student Lali Hoinaki. It works like this. Assume we want to generate, to construct a band-limited function whose bandwidth is capital omega. And we want it to have a lot of zero crossings in a particular interval. So let's say the bandwidth should be 1 hertz. But we want that in a second it has a million zero crossings. How can we do this? So Lali's method works like this. Imagine you take n functions. So let's say we want n zero crossings in a small interval. Then you take n functions, arbitrary functions, which obey just one requirement. They have to be omega divided by n band limited. So for example, if our bandwidth, our required bandwidth at the end is 1 hertz, and you want a million zero crossings later on in the small interval, then these functions should be picked in such a way that their bandwidth is each one of them has a bandwidth of 1 millionth of a hertz. So each one of these functions is super slowly oscillating, 1 millionth of a hertz. Well, then if you multiply all those functions together, then their product has bandwidth 1 hertz. And that's because multiplication in the time domain is convolution in the frequency domain. And this is usual Fourier theory. If you first multiply and then Fourier transform, it's the same as first Fourier transforming, then convolving. And the convolution will just add to the bandwidth. So if you multiply n 1 over n band-limited functions, the product will have bandwidth omega, which is our target bandwidth. Now, the product of these n functions, the product of these capital N functions, is going to be a function that has zero crossings. But where? Well, it will inherit all the zero crossings of the n functions that went into it, right? Because we're just multiplying them. So the product inherit, the product of all these functions, the functions which is the product of all these functions, is of course inheriting all the zero crossings of the gn. Now I can choose for gn some arbitrary band-limited functions with bandwidth omega divided by n. It will have some zero crossing. And then the other gn's are simply chosen to be the same as my first g1, but just shifted by a millionth of a second. In this way, G1 has a zero crossing somewhere, and G2 has a zero crossing just a millionth of a second later. G3 has a zero crossing again a millionth of a second later, and so on. We multiply all those functions. Their product is omega band limited, and they have zero crossings. inherited at the distance of a second. And you see, this is just multiplication. You don't have to invert any matrices for this. So it's numerically stable. And we can generate arbitrarily highly super oscillating functions. We are not able to prescribe with this method what the function exactly does, but we make sure it has so many zero constants. Okay, so that was the first numerically stable method to make super oscillations. Now, Lucia and I accepted this new student, Barbara Schroeder, and in October she came up with a method that allows you to construct super oscillatory functions, again, as super oscillatory as you want, and completely stable. And you can now also choose what exactly the function is doing in here. And here's how that works. The basic idea is this. Polynomials have zero bandwidth. Now, if you're not familiar with this, let's think it through. What's the bandwidth of the constant function? That's the easiest polynomial. Well, what's the bandwidth of the constant function? Well, it's Fourier transform. The Fourier transform of the constant function is a Dirac delta. And that means its support in the frequency domain is just one point. OK, now the next polynomial would be t, the linear polynomial t. Its Fourier transform is the derivative of the Dirac delta. Again, support only at zero. And it goes on like this. T to the seventh power has as its Fourier transform the seventh derivative, or minus I times the seventh derivative of the Dirac delta. So all of these have only support at the origin. So polynomials, linear combinations of these guys, also have zero support, which means that if you multiply a polynomial with a band-limited function, you are not changing its bandwidth. It stays the same. So then the idea is this. Let's say you want that your function has a particular behavior in this interval. So it goes like this, super oscillating, but in a particular way. You choose what it exactly has to do. Let's look at this particular part. So you prescribe a particular function there. And let's assume that the function that you want to prescribe is an analytic function, right? I mean, if we want a step function, we can't have that. But let's say it's an analytic function. Then we do the Taylor series of it. In fact, we do the Taylor series up to a finite power. Then it's just a Taylor polynomial. So we take our function, let's call this function f here. So this is f of t, just over here, right? Just in this interval, just here, it's f of t. Or here, sorry, here I wrote f of x. And we do the Taylor expansion of it, let's say around the point in the middle, it doesn't really matter where. And we can go in this expansion as high as we want, and that will approximate our function over here with arbitrary accuracy. So we go as high as we want so that the Taylor polynomial approximates our function's desired behavior in that interval with as much accuracy as we want. And then we choose a function of band-limited omega, the target bandwidth, which is basically one in that interval. That's not so hard to do, because all we want is a slowly varying function, low bandwidth function, like 1 hertz bandwidth function, which doesn't change much over that interval. This could be, for example, a sinc function, a very wide sinc function, or a product of a very wide sinc function. So we choose a band-limited, omega band-limited function, which is very wide, and basically constantly one in that interval. And after that, it does its thing so that it's omega band limited. But basically, it's not hard to find functions that are slowly varying here, pretty much one with as much accuracy as you want. And then overall, it's the square integrable and also fall off fast enough. there are methods to construct such functions. And then we just multiply them. We take the slowly varying function, which is as close to 1 on the interval that we care about, and multiply it with our Taylor polynomial. The point being that the Taylor polynomial multiplying that function, which is basically 1, gives us the desired behavior without changing the bandwidth of the function. So overall, we have a function of bandwidth omega, which as accurately as we want it, will have the desired behavior over there. Now you may wonder, that looks too easy. There's got to be some price to pay. And there is, of course, a price to pay, not just in this method, but in any method to generate superoscillations, and I will get to that. But before we get to the price that needs to be paid to get superoscillations, maybe let me just anticipate what the price will be. The price to pay is that the more conditions you put on how that should look like in here, the larger will the dynamic range have to be. And that means the larger these large amplitudes will have to be in comparison to the amplitudes that you're prescribing there. This is the cost that we have to pay. This is the price to pay. Super oscillations are possible with arbitrary accuracy, arbitrarily high frequencies, but they come at the cost of having a huge dynamic range. And exactly how the dynamic range scales with the requirements, I will get to a little later. But first, what might super oscillations be good for? Well, super oscillations could be good for overcoming general wavelength limitations. For example, in a field called optogenetics. I don't know if you're familiar with this. So optogenetics is the research field where biological organisms are genetically modified such that certain proteins either become able to emit light under certain circumstances. If something gets activated in a cell, these proteins will start emitting light, which we can then detect in order to find out what happened in the cell, like, oh, this protein was activated. Some metabolic pathway is being activated. So we see that because the cell is actually emitting light. Or alternatively, a protein might become sensitive to light because of the genetic modification, which means that we can irradiate the tissue with light of a certain wavelength, and then that will change the biological behavior. So we can talk with the biological tissue using light after having suitably modified the proteins. That's optogenetics. Now, in the field of optogenetics, there is a conundrum, which is that when talking to the biological tissue, we want to talk with blue light usually because it's more energetic than red light is. But the trouble with blue light is that it doesn't go very far in tissue. If, for example, as is often the case, we want to do optogenetics in the brain, well, then blue light doesn't really penetrate much. Red light would. Infrared light would even do it better. So there is perhaps an opportunity to use super oscillatory waveforms, because you could have red light as far as the Fourier transform is concerned, but it has a blue stretch in it, because the super oscillating part might be in the blue wavelength. Another possibility is to use super oscillations in other circumstances where the bandwidth is limited, in bandwidth-limited communication. For example, in very crowded communication circumstances where you have lots of wireless communication going on and they have to share tiny pieces of bandwidth, maybe it is possible to use it there. I mean, it's the opposite of communicating with a spacecraft, for example, because there you're power limited. And you have all the frequency band in the world to communicate because you're doing a directional communication and so you're not bandwidth limited, but you're more signal to noise limited there. Another possible application area of super oscillations is super resolution, and that field has recently taken off over the past 5 to 10 years. The idea there is to use super oscillatory waveforms to obtain a resolution beyond the diffraction level. Ordinarily, we say that you can't resolve in microscopy, for example, anything smaller than the wavelength that you use, to a factor of 2. But with super-oscillatory waveforms, you get waveforms that have tiny little structure in them, and you might be able to use that to get a resolution beyond the diffraction limit, beyond the size of the wavelength that you're using. I've even heard experimentalists say, and I emphasize experimentalists, that it might be possible to see atoms with visible light. Now, I'm sure I'm not an experimentalist, but it sounds dubious to me. But it would be fantastic, of course. But then there is the challenge to obtain resolution better than the wavelengths, not only in optics, but also, for example, in radar. And I will talk about this a little later, later on. For example, you may want to find landmines in the ground. Ideally, you'd fly with a helicopter over the landscape and then have radar to map out where the landmines are. The trouble is that radar uses wavelengths of about this size, which is the size of the landmines, and that makes sense. But electromagnetic waves of this wavelength are also known as microwaves and used in microwave ovens because they get so readily absorbed by water molecules. It's the rotational degree of freedom that absorbs them very efficiently, which means we can't do it. We can't fly with, I mean, we can fly with a helicopter over a landmine field, but we can't map out the landmines because any trace of humidity in the soil absorbs our waves. Except if we had wavelengths larger than this, like a meter, then they would penetrate the ground because they're outside the absorption band of the water. But they are too long, these wavelengths, to see things as small as landmines. So maybe super oscillations could help there. I will get into this a little later. And finally, and that I cannot make clear at this point, but I will make it clear later in this talk, we can also use super oscillations to probe fast dissipative processes in media. For example, the process by which water molecules absorb super oscillatory signals and then dissipate the energy into the environment. So here's the example of landmine detection. Landmines have sizes of the order of 10 centimeters, and radar of such wavelengths is absorbed by humidity. Even just a layer of leaves on the soil destroys the ability to see landmines. And then any humidity does it, and the soil does it too. So the idea is to use super oscillatory radar pulses with wavelengths above a meter, and then the water molecules should only temporarily get excited by the 10 centimeter wavelength super oscillations in it, but not permanently. See, if you've ever calculated the harmonic oscillator, quantumly or classically, the harmonic oscillator driven by an external driving force temporarily, then remember what the outcome is. If you have a pulse of driving on a harmonic oscillator, and then after a while the pulse is gone, what's the state of the harmonic oscillator? Is it going to be excited or not? The answer is, it's going to be excited to a level which is proportional to the Fourier component of the driving force at the resonance frequency of the harmonic oscillator. So if the resonance frequency of the harmonic oscillator was like 7 hertz, then you just need to take the Fourier transform of the driving force and evaluate it at 7 hertz. And if, for example, there was no component of 7 hertz, if the driving force did not contain 7 hertz, then after the pulse is gone, the harmonic oscillator is back to the ground state. Quantumly and classically, it's back to standing still. It's the same classically and quantumly. So this means that if we have a signal, a radar signal that's super oscillatory, but has only wavelength above 1 meter, then that's out of the resonance of the water molecules. So therefore, temporarily, while this electromagnetic wave goes over the water molecules, such a water molecule sees the electromagnetic field, it will get shaken But after the signal has passed, it will be in its ground state again. So therefore, we have transparency. At least that's what we should have. So if the radar pulses are not absorbed by the water molecules because of that, because they're out of resonance, then we should have super resolution. We should be able to, well, at least have a chance to see landmines, because we can have waveforms that are much shorter than the 1 meter wavelength, maybe 5 centimeters or so, and then we should be able to detect the landmines.
I mean, in the limit where you make the high frequency pulse long, it's absorbed.
So you
can only do this by making it short.
We'll get to it. Actually, even when short, it doesn't work.
Okay.
But let me explain exactly what's going on here. So what's going on is that in practice, the water molecules are not patient enough. If one of those water molecules was in isolation, then things would happen the way I just explained. So they would temporarily get excited because of all of this going on, and then all of that going on, and all of this going on, but at the end, they would not be excited. But the water molecules are not in isolation. They are embedded in an environment, and they interact at a high rate with their neighbors. And what happens if one of those water molecules is, let's say, at this stage, it's been excited, or maybe at that stage, it's been excited, but now in this excited state, it bumps into a neighbor. Well, then it can dissipate its energy to the neighbor. And then, yes, the rest of the wave will wash over it, but now it's completely out of phase, and there's no chance that it would completely withdraw its energy again, that the wave would withdraw its energy again from our water molecule. So therefore, the water molecules will actually dissipate the energy, and we don't have transparency. It's basically because the water molecules have a time window in which they are undisturbed, which is short compared to the length of the pulse of the radar signal. Of course, this thing is traveling at the speed of light, or almost the speed of light in the medium. But you can calculate how long it takes to cross a water molecule, and you can calculate how long it takes for a water molecule to bump into its neighbor and then bump into the next neighbor. And it just so turns out, when you do the back of the envelope calculation, that the time window that the water molecule has between two bumps into neighbors is short compared to the length of the pulse, if this is a wavelength of a meter. So therefore, unfortunately, it probably doesn't work this way. You can't detect landmines in this way. So that is a problem for the opportunity of super resolution. But this bug may be turned into a feature too, because it gives us the opportunity to detect these fast dissipative processes. So in the soil, we may not be able to detect landmines, but in general, if we use super oscillatory waveforms and send them through media of various kinds, then we can check the absorption properties of the medium with respect to the super oscillations there. And from this, we can find out how big the time window is that the individual particles or individual degrees of freedom have between interactions with their neighbors. So we can experimentally probe fast dissipative processes by using these signals.
Do you have any actual examples where it would be useful, like the biological example you gave?
Yes, there the orders of magnitude are actually the same, and it could be that you can just tune it in such a way that you might be able to do it.
Has anybody tried taking brain imaging? Or...
No, not yet. Well, I haven't published this yet. I've only talked about it at the conference and at the institute. Now, what is the cost for having super oscillations? There is a cost, and I mentioned it already. It's the fact that the more you prescribe here, the larger the dynamic range has to be. Already Aharonov And Berry observed that the super oscillations that they were making had huge amplitudes to the left and to the right of them. So if those super oscillations had amplitudes one, then those might be, you know, a million, a billion. It depends on how many super oscillations and how fast the super oscillations you are prescribing. So with my colleague Paulo Ferreira, we proved two scaling laws for super oscillations. We showed that the minimum dynamic range of super oscillating functions has two scaling laws. The dynamic range grows exponentially with the number of super oscillations. Okay, so if you have here, just in the simple case, it doesn't have to be simple super oscillations like this. It always applies, but it's easier to think of it in this way. The more oscillations you prescribe, the larger the slopes to the left and to the right have to be. And the size of these slopes, or more accurately, the L2 norm under them, has to grow exponentially with the number of the super oscillations. Which means you can't really do many super oscillations. You can approximate, for example, a piece of music. But if you want an hour of a Beethoven symphony embedded with a reasonable accuracy in a 1 hertz band limited signal, the dynamic range would have to be, you know, 10 to 1,000 or something like this. Completely impossible. So the dynamic range of super oscillations grows exponentially with the number of super oscillations that you prescribe. And the dynamic range grows polynomially with the frequency of the super oscillation. So if we leave the number of super oscillations the same, but we increase the frequency, when that also requires a larger dynamic range, but it grows only polynomially. And the power with which it grows is the number of super oscillations that we have. Now you might think, okay, that's pretty bad, an exponential growth of the dynamic range with the number of super oscillations. So that means we can't go very far. Well, except in optics, we actually have quite a number of orders of magnitude to work with. If, for example, you take a laser, then, you know, how many photons can you make with a regular laser? Well, it's about 10 to the 20 per second. You can easily make 10 to the 20 photons per second. And you can count individual photons. So you can work with a loss of 10 to the minus 20. So that gives you quite a few orders of magnitude, which means in optics, you can actually go quite some way. You can, in principle, generate some, I mean, for example, it should be possible, I don't think anybody has done it, but it should be possible to use red light, which has a blue stretch in it. Should not be hard to do. After all, the blue has just half the wavelength of red. So it's not an extreme thing to do. Okay, so this is the cost for having super oscillations. Now, what insights can be gained from super oscillations? Remember that super oscillations originally were found in the context of weak measurements. This is where Andrew Popescu and Akira Aronoff and Michael Berry were looking into it. And you may have heard of the paper that's called "If You Measure Spin 1/2, You Might Find Spin 100," things like that. It has to do with this, right? That you have a certain bandwidth, but you can still find much faster oscillations that the bandwidth indicate. So they have their origin in quantum foundation super oscillations. But I think it goes beyond that. Let me mention one immediate application of super oscillations in quantum mechanics, and then two not so immediate ones. So one is, imagine you're creating a super oscillatory wave function. Quantum mechanical super oscillatory wave function looks something like this, and you run that wave function against a single slit. So Here we have a single slit experiment. And we have here an electron come in this direction. And the wave function in the transversal direction has low bandwidth, which means that the electron has no probability to move left or right with any significant velocity. The wave function might look something like this. Large amplitudes here, and then here, very fast oscillations, and like that. If you do the Fourier transform of it, the wave function, then it shows no momenta larger than a certain maximum momentum, not smaller than a certain minimum momentum in this direction. Then you run this wave function against the single slit. Since these amplitudes are much larger than those amplitudes, I didn't draw them to scale here. Since these are much larger than those in here, most of the time the electron will run against one of the walls and get absorbed. But if the electron makes it through, then the wave function becomes, of course, just this one, renormalized. And we know that the Fourier transform of this piece is going to show high frequencies. In fact, it's going to show those high frequencies that we designed into it. Right? Remember, we can design exactly how that function looks like to arbitrary accuracy. And so therefore, we can, for example, design it in such a way that this is a complex function which describes a particle shooting off in this direction. We can preordain that, which is weird, because where does it take its momentum from? It is as if this particle was spring-loaded. As long as it has its entire wave function down here, it doesn't possess large momentum, neither to the left nor to the right. The Fourier transform simply has a very limited compact support in the frequency domain. But then this part is what we want it to be. And in particular, we can make it shoot off in this direction, that direction, and as fast as we want to.
But if we ran the clock backwards, it would leap off to the left and the right, going backwards in time and speed. So I'm not sure what the difference is.
I don't know why you think you can, but why can you run it backwards?
Just take the original wave function and go backwards in time, yeah.
Yes.
Then it would shoot off.
Yeah, but remember that if you do the Fourier transform of it, yeah, it doesn't have that in it.
Doesn't matter. Still, there will be some pulse going left and some pulse going right. I'm not sure it's so different.
Yeah, but it is a very small amplitude, right? Very small amplitude there. But you're right. Of course, it has that component in it.
It does. It would do that. There's a conspiracy needed before the slit.
Yes, but remember the conspiracy is two ways, because you have the high frequencies in here, but you also have the same high frequencies in the rest, so that they cancel out.
Yes.
So all of this generates a motion in that direction, because this backwards in time would generate a motion in that direction. Yeah, but it would be interesting to see, to evolve it backwards. And you said you have methods to actually calculate that.
Yes.
Let's do it. Okay, very good. So now, in principle, a similar problem arises with a single slit experiment anyway, even if it wasn't super oscillatory. And that's a question that already Feynman addressed. Feynman said, let's say we have here the single slit experiment, and we have a wave coming which has almost no momentum left or right. And then it gets projected here, and then it becomes a function that looks like this. It's zero because of the blockage from the wall. And then the amplitude shoots up, it's almost constant, and then it goes down again. And these sharp corners mean that after the electron has made it to the slit, it is likely to go off in any direction. Right? I mean, you know, the wave picture is, of course, this, that that if a plane wave comes in like this, it goes out like that, right? So there is a momentum this way, that way. And in Feynman's lectures, you can find his beautiful discussion of this. He says, well, the electron goes left and right with momenta that it didn't have before. Where does the momentum come from? And the energy. And the answer is, of course, it has to come from the slit walls. There is no other place it could come from. But then he says, what if the slit walls don't have energy momentum to give? What if I cool them down to zero temperature? So they don't have energy momentum to give. Does the pattern disappear? No, it doesn't disappear. The electron still withdraws energy and momentum from the slit walls. And it can do this because the slit walls will have some momentum and some momentum uncertainty. But then Feynman says, well, okay, but I can help that. I can make sure that the momentum of the slit walls is zero, and I make the uncertainty momentum also as small as I want. Now the slit walls really don't have momentum to give. Well, in that case, the slit is not here. In that case, we don't know where the slit walls are, because if we know the momentum, we don't know the position. So now the electron can arrive over here on the screen, not because it was deflected, but because the opening was here. Now, with super oscillations, it's the same picture in principle, except that we can force it now. Except that now we can choose exactly in which direction, with what momentum it shoots off. We can preordain that it is spring-loaded to do this if it makes it through the slit. It is a little bit as if it was a cooling ray, because it will extract energy from those slit walls if it makes it through. And thermodynamically, I'm not sure what it means, but it's non-trivial. You can't just have cooling rays. You shoot something and it will cool it down, even if it doesn't have anything. Even if it's already at zero temperature, it still withdraws energy from it. It's a weird thing. So I think it probably has some quantum thermodynamic consequences. Actually, I'm getting back to this in point B. I mixed up the sequence of the slide. So what we are arriving at is what might be called cooling rays. So if you have a beam of electrons towards the screen with a slit, super oscillatory where the slit is, and electrons that pass the slit will be accelerated. This energy comes from the slit wall, even if they don't have, even if they are at zero temperature, we are still withdrawing energy from them. And how does quantum thermodynamics account for that? Should be interesting to find out. And of course, this is still an unsolved experimental challenge. How can we arrange for quantum mechanical wave functions to be super oscillatory? Now, I wrote papers, for example, with my student Eugene Tang and with Navneet Garg, where we and also with Lai Li and others, where we studied possible ways to make super oscillatory quantum mechanical wave function. Very difficult, though. So we know a lot now about what the shape of potentials has to be, such that, for example, the ground state wave function is super oscillatory. But you know, it's not easy, because ground state wave functions don't want to have any zero crossings. But you can have your super oscillations above zero, right? You don't have to oscillate around zero. They could oscillate around the finite value. So things like that can be done. But it's very difficult. And we still don't really have a good proposal for an experiment that they could do. You can always prescribe a potential, but how do you make that potential? And so one general way of thinking about this goes back to Benny Resnik, who suggested that super oscillatory waveforms might arise in black holes. His argument was that as you follow Hawking radiation back towards the horizon of a black hole, it's going to be blue shifted. Now, if you subscribe to the idea that there is a fundamental length cutoff at the Planck length, then that implies something like a band limitation that's being enforced. And so the combination of forcing a blue shift while also forcing a band limitation might lead to the formation of super oscillations. Maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't. I don't know. Nobody knows so well about black holes. But the general idea, I think, is very interesting. Namely, we can try to think of physical mechanisms that we could experimentally realize in which we, on one hand, force a blue shift, for example, suitably in media. We can do that by changing the diffractive element. And at the same time, force a band limitation, for example, through the lattice spacing in the media. And then maybe the combination of the two could give you that an incoming oscillatory, ordinary oscillatory wave becomes super oscillatory. But this hasn't been carried through yet. So far, this is just an idea. All right. So, and let me mention finally that super oscillations not only challenge quantum thermodynamics, super oscillations also challenge our understanding of information theory itself. I shouldn't say challenge, it's just creating new food for thought and opportunity. At the heart of information theory is the Shannon-Hartley theorem. It tells us how much information there is in a continuous signal. It's super non-trivial because information is a discrete concept. It's so many bits. And continuous signals, well, they are continuous. So how can we quantify how much information there is in a continuous signal? This is super non-trivial. Think about it this way. If you could truly transmit a continuous signal, you wouldn't even need to send any time evolution of it. If you could just transmit one amplitude, you could already transmit an infinite amount of information. Because if you could transmit just one number, one real number, then in the digits of that real number, you could encode the Encyclopedia Britannica, just in the digits of this one number. So something has to regulate. And that something is, of course, noise. A continuous signal has to be band limited and have noise. Then it will have a finite information content. And the Shannon-Hartley theorem explains exactly how much it is. So the Shannon-Hartley theorem says this. Consider an omega band limited channel that allows you to transmit omega band limited signals, and assume that this channel is burdened with additive Gaussian white noise. And let's assume that the average signal to noise power ratio is S divided by N, average signal power, average noise power. Then it can be proven that the capacity in bits per second is given by the bandwidth times the log to base 2, because you want to work with bits, 1 plus signal to noise ratio. This theorem is not constructive. It's an existence theorem. It only tells you that there exists a coding scheme, and in general, it's not possible to calculate that coding scheme. There are theorems that say you can't calculate which one it is. But it proves that there is a coding scheme such that you can send so many bits through that channel with an as small as you like error rate for given bandwidth and signal to noise ratio. And that coding scheme, of course, works basically by using redundancy. But using redundancy in your coding in the most clever way. As you can imagine, that is super important. It's always applied in practice. Now, while a lot of people think, the general public, I suppose, thinks that the data transmission rate through a transmission line is the bandwidth, it's of course not, right? The data transmission rate is the bandwidth times this. You could have a tiny bandwidth and still send a huge amount of data. For example, you could have a phone line with 5 kilohertz bandwidth and still send gigabytes per second through it. You just have to have a tremendously small signal to noise ratio. So one feature of this theorem is, for example, and I just mentioned this because it's a curious fact, no matter how bad the signal to noise ratio is, so no matter how small that number is, the signal power may be not just equal to the noise, it might be much smaller to the noise. It could be that the noise power is a million times higher than the signal power. Then it doesn't mean that C is zero. No, you still have a capacity. No matter how much noise there is of that kind, of the additive Gaussian white noise, there's always a finite capacity to send information through that channel. This, by the way, is not true for quantum channel capacity. It can suddenly die. You increase the noise level by just a little bit at a finite level, it'll kill it. Quantum channel capacity being the ability to transmit entanglement through a channel. Okay, so what we see here is that if you want to increase the capacity in your communication, there are two ways to do it. You can either increase the bandwidth of your phone line or whatever it might be, and that will work proportionally, or you can increase, you can improve your signal-to-noise ratio. But that's not very efficient because it's logarithmically suppressed. You really have to shout. Right? It doesn't work that well. But now let's think about super oscillations. What about super oscillations given that theorem here? It would seem that we can prescribe arbitrarily many features in here in our super oscillating stretch. In fact, by Barbara's method, we can prescribe our function with arbitrary accuracy in here. So what gives? Well, the theorem must be true, it's been proven. The super oscillations, yeah, we can make them, no doubt about it. It's easy to prove. So something has to give. And yeah, what gives is that, I mean, this is totally consistent. Because what we are seeing here is that, yes, you can keep the bandwidth the same and increase the capacity by stuffing information into here. You can do this. But the Shannon-Hartley theorem tells you if you keep this the same and increase that, you have to increase the signal-to-noise ratio exponentially, because it's logarithmically suppressed. Which is to say that the Shannon-Hartley theorem tells us there's an exponential price to pay if you want to use super oscillations to squeeze more information through a low bandwidth channel. Can do it, but it's exponential price to pay, which is what we knew before. Because we knew from super oscillations, from their scaling law, that indeed, the more information you pack in there, the exponentially more must be the dynamic range of the signal. The super oscillating function has to have exponentially larger amplitude to the left and to the right of what you actually, what your coding region is. So what we see here is it's nicely consistent. The scaling law, the scaling laws of super oscillations are beautifully consistent with what the Shannon-Hartley theorem says. Super oscillation scaling law says that we have exponentially exploding signal-to-noise ratio as we pack more and more information into it, as we prescribe more and more amplitudes in there. And the Shannon-Hartley theorem says the same thing. If we keep the bandwidth the same, the capacity can be increased, but the signal-to-noise ratio has to increase exponentially. But remember, it's not the same. Signal-to-noise ratio is not the same as dynamic range. It's almost the same. And another thing is very curious here, which is that we didn't use any noise model here. Whereas in the Shannon-Hartley theorem, we make the assumption that the noise is additive, Gaussian, white noise. Then you can prove this. If you have a different noise, you have to go back to square one and prove a similar theorem, but it won't be exactly this. For every noise model, you have to prove this effect. Super oscillations don't care about noise. The scaling law simply says, generally, the more oscillations you prescribe, the larger is going to be the dynamic range. And I think that's an opportunity, because it means that it may be possible to reformulate the Shannon-Hartley theorem to make it much more general, to get a Shannon-Hartley theorem type theorem, which is independent of what noise model it is. You see, the super oscillations tell us that there has got to be this exponential scaling independently of noise. So the challenge is to translate the dynamic range scaling to a signal-to-noise ratio scaling. And all the other features are almost the same. The bandwidth is the bandwidth. The only other feature that needs to be translated is here we have capacity. Here we say bits per second. Here we say number of prescribed amplitudes. Right? So the dynamic range, which stands for the signal-to-noise ratio, scales exponentially with the number of super oscillations that we prescribe, which stands for the amount of information that we plug into it. So this project is only at the beginning, but the hope is that we generalize the Shannon-Hartley theorem to a much more general theorem that doesn't rely on any particular noise model. And we can already see the outline of it. Basically, it's got to have this exponential behavior, no matter what, logarithmic behavior, no matter what, because otherwise, super oscillations could beat it. Right. Okay, that's just what I said. So the challenge is there a noise model independent Shannon-Hartley theorem which replaces signal-to-noise ratio by dynamic range and which replaces number of super oscillations prescribed by number of bits sent. All right, this is already what we said. And then summary. So what are super oscillations? Oscillations faster than what the Fourier transform would indicate. How to make them? Well, multiplicatively, either with Lely's method or with Barbara's method. What are they good for? They're good for super resolution. And whenever they're not good for super resolution, because the molecule in question has too short a time window between two bumps into neighbors, whenever super oscillations cannot be used for super resolution, therefore, then we can probe what prevents the super resolution, fast dissipation, where a molecule gives the energy that it gets from the signal, where it gives it to its neighbors. And that could have applications of genetics, for example. What is the cost of super oscillations? Well, they come with large dynamic ranges. But we shouldn't be too afraid of that because we have at least 20 orders of magnitude to work with because we can count individual photons while we are able to produce easily 10 to the 20 per second. So we have 20 orders of magnitude to work with. And then what can we learn from their existence? Well, possibly a deeper understanding of channel capacities in information theory. And that was just a classical part of it. Who knows what they do in quantum information theory? I don't think anybody has looked into this. And we can possibly also get a deeper understanding of quantum thermodynamics. This business with the cooling rays is still to be explored. Thank you very much.
Good questions?
Do you know if there's any non-trivial relation between the accuracy of the super oscillating part and accuracy of the rest? Like say if you use Barbara's method, like, you know, you want some accuracy for the super oscillating part, how accurate do you have to be outside?
Yes. Oh, no, that's an interesting question. Yeah, the answer is that as you increase the accuracy with which you prescribe what's going on in the super oscillating part by Barbara's method, then the outside changes a lot. And you can see it this way. As you increase the accuracy in here with Barbara's method, what you need to do is go higher in the Taylor expansion. So you have a higher Taylor polynomial. But remember what we do. We have a band-limited function, which is almost one here and then quickly decays. And that band-limited function is multiplied with this polynomial. And what you will have is that in the super oscillating stretch, the band-limited function is just almost one, and we have this Taylor polynomial, so we get what we want with higher and higher accuracy. But outside, a fight is going on, because outside, the polynomial wants to blow up. And the more accuracy we want, the higher the polynomial, the faster it will blow up. Therefore, our band-limited function that is almost one here has to suppress this, has to suppress the blowing up polynomials. And this is why the lobes to the left and to the right of the super oscillating stretch get so large, right? Because the polynomials will grow until the band-limited function kicks in and suppresses them down, right? And so as you increase the accuracy, the higher the polynomial and the larger the amplitudes get before they eventually die down. And not only do they get larger, but also different, because as you change the degree of the polynomial, you know, you have, if it's an odd polynomial, then it blows up in this way. If it's an even polynomial, it blows up in that way. So it completely changes the outside.
Any questions? Tobias did.
Yeah. So you've measured the cost in terms of this dynamic range, but how about, let's say, you measured the cost in terms of L2 norm or in terms of the energy of the wave?
It's actually the L2 norm. It's actually the L2 norm, and then because you can generate your super oscillating function using sync functions whose decay behavior we have, we can then, from the L2 norm, infer what it does for the dynamic range. I was just speaking of the dynamic range because it's sort of more intuitive.
Right. And considering the Taylor expansion, have you considered using a Chebyshev approximation instead, which in general is much better?
No, we haven't,
also,
but that's a possibility, yeah.
Works for all continuous functions as opposed to analytic
functions.
Yes,
yes.
So, first of all, thanks for a really great talk. This is very clear and really thought provoking. So, I have a few questions. If people discuss using superoscillations to get sub Planckian features, it would seem like you might be able to do that. Is that something that people study?
Yes, so we wrote a paper on entanglement entropy in quantum field theories with a natural ultraviolet cutoff. And then we looked at the sampling theory of it. If you have a function in span limited, then it suffices to know what it does at discrete points, and then you can reconstruct what it does everywhere. However, what if your functions are super oscillatory? Then the sampling theorem still applies. It just becomes less stable. So that small measurement errors would translate into large reconstruction errors. And we did that for quantum field theory. And so we were interested in how densely packed the degrees of freedom of the quantum field are when you assume that there's a natural ultraviolet cutoff. And when you then probe the field at neighboring points that are closer than the Nyquist spacing, closer than the spacing that would be appropriate for the bandwidth, then you're probing basically the same degrees of freedom. We were checking whether that's the case or not, given the existence of super oscillations, and it's still the case. So it's quite nice because it feels as if you could pack more and more information into a quantum field by disregarding the bandwidth and just stuffing more information into a small region, but you can't really do that. It's rigid in that sense. It's a paper with William Donnelly and with Jason Pye.
Okay, ask a couple more questions. I don't know exactly how to find a measure over waveforms, but is there any sense in which show that super oscillations are sort of not typical? Like if I sort of randomly selected a waveform, relative to some natural measure, these are a set of measure zero.
This is a very good question. And it has been an active field of research. I think the most active person to pursue this has been Michael Berry. And he wrote the most amazing claims. So he writes that if you just look at a noise field, just Gaussian random noise, then by some criterion, which I'm not completely subscribing to, he says that they're actually quite frequent. That basically, just a random noise field is already full of them. He says in certain circumstances, you could have like at 30% of the places where you look, there would be some oscillation. But of course, that could be any oscillation. It's just a tiny little bit faster than you might expect on the basis of Fourier. So the extreme oscillations, of course, will be extremely unlikely. But if you're just looking for anything that's faster than Fourier, then it's actually fairly frequent.
I thought he was saying a little more than that, but for example, if you look at the electric field, it will have topological singularities in the polarization. The field is supposed to be zero. And if you look near the zeros of the field where it winds around, then it's super oscillatory next to the zero. And so the super oscillation is kind of forced on you by the topology of the field space.
Yes. Yes, that's true. But I understood Rob's question as asking if you have sort of a measure of all possible configurations, like a noise, some sort of noise model, then how frequent is it there? I mean, I agree, you can force them.
Well, no, no, but this is just saying electromagnetic field at finite temperature. That's a very well.
Oh, I see. You mean these vortices would occur naturally?
Kinematical vortices. Yeah, they're not really dynamical. They just happen. Just places where the electric field happens to wind around, and near those, it's super asymmetric. So in that sense, it's very hard to avoid them.
But can we use it to filter them out?
He seemed to think possibly yes, but you know that remains to be seen. But there may be topological reasons why the momentum has to be very large in certain localized regions.
And if super oscillations can be viewed as frequently occurring under certain circumstances, then if given their property of basically spring-loading the corresponding quantum, there's got to be some thermodynamic limitations to filtering them out, to distilling them out. Maybe they can be used for something like evaporative cooling, where you're sort of skimming off the highest momentum.
I think this would. I mean, there's no doubt a Maxwell field in thermal equilibrium is in equilibrium. There's nothing. Just look at it in Fourier space; it's in equilibrium.
Yeah.
But it would also have super oscillations present, so they come and go, and they take care of it.
No, I understand. But just like when you have a super oscillating function like this,
yes,
then you can pass them through a single slit and skim off the high momentum, right? And I'm just wondering if in thermal equilibrium, even you might imagine having them in a cavity which has tiny holes and you know,
it must somehow take care of itself.
It's got to, yes, of course. It's not going to violate the same law.
Well, just to finish up this. So, if I'm understanding correctly, there's a sense in which maybe super oscillations are typical behavior. And you know, so that the engineering project would be to have them in a particular form. But if they're sort of arising naturally, then it's conceivable that they should factor into the explanations of certain phenomena. That maybe you know, their typicality means that you know we could reconceive certain things.
Do you have phenomena in mind?
No, I don't. But if it is indeed sort of typical, then maybe it's a useful lens on things that we used to explain in this way. If we reconceive those
phenomena
with respect to super oscillations, we get a very elegant new kind of explanation of them.
Yes.
That would be nice. Yeah, yeah.
So, I guess it's just interesting.
I like it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Sandy was here last week and I was talking to him about this. I mean, one interesting thing is that in nonlinear classical dynamics, you're never surprised with frequencies, let's say, cascaded to high frequencies. That's generic behavior. A couple, some oscillators together with some nonlinearity, the frequencies will double every oscillation just due to the nonlinear turn, so that will escalate. And so maybe the wild speculation, the super oscillations are somehow the quantum, i.e. linear, version of this nonlinear phenomenon, which is generic classical. So.
Oh, that's cool. You see, that reminds me of the challenge to define what is quantum chaos. Because classically, things can have these Lyapunov exponents.
Which are completely generic,
They're completely generic. Exactly. But quantum mechanically, of course, if you have two initial states that are just epsilon apart by some measure, then the unitary time evolution will not drive them further apart. It just won't, because it's linear, right? And then you have to take all sorts of other measures to get the quantum analogon of quantum chaos, and maybe super oscillation somehow are a manifestation of that sort of thing. Nice.
So it seems like you talked about water molecules, and they don't really work very well because they bump into each other on too short a time scale.
Yeah.
Could you imagine, just theoretically, you could try to reverse engineer what properties you would want for your matter to have so it would interact optimally with this sort of super operation oscillations, and that might be useful. For example, you know, so you could ask a patient to swallow the substance that would interact optimally or something of this sort. I guess already you have a pretty good insight into what kind of properties such materials should have. Is that right?
Well, in the simplest case, it would just be the resonance frequency. We could just have a monochromatic super oscillating strand. And then have a molecule that has a narrow resonance at that frequency. And then the overall signal wouldn't contain it. But the molecule could still see it if its time window is of that order of magnitude. So then you could have, you see, for example, now you may wonder, why don't I just irradiate the molecule with that radiation anyway? But the trouble is that sometimes that just wouldn't penetrate the tissue, or it would, but damage it. For example, if you take wavelengths that are too short, then they could be ionizing. For example, with dental x-rays, that's an issue that they always ionize to some extent. And therefore, more recently, there have been studies, and I had a project with a company that does that. They use terahertz waves of millimeter and just sub-millimeter wavelength to do something like radar or x-ray, but using just these millimeter waves to study teeth or to study the skin. And the point about this is that these waves are in a far infrared, and so they don't ionize. And you can go up with the amplitude as much as you want. So you could imagine that you use harmless, because non-ionizing radiation to get some place in the tissue, but then you still deliver some high frequency pulse somewhere to some molecule that needs it. Yeah, it would be great to find application.
So we have to go through. This is never talking here, but maybe one last question. Rob has one more question. So this question's not that well formulated, but let's see if there's a connection. So if you look at just the wave functions and you think about the variance in momentum, so you know, old papers on quantum theory used to conceptualize the variance in momentum somehow as capturing your uncertainty of what we can of the momentum measurement. But you know, over the years, a lot of people pointed out that it's not a very good measure of uncertainty, that really you ought to be using like entropies or something like that over the distribution of momentum. And the variance doesn't really tell you very much about how uncertain you are. But these days, there is an operational interpretation of the variance from the perspective of the resource theory of asymmetry. So you can prove a result that says, if I want to know how sensitive is the wave function to translations in space, so how well could I use this wave function to detect a small translation in space? And then if you define that in a certain way, you'll find the variance of the momentum quantifies that. So it seems to me here that in this case, the variance of momentum is something like the bandwidth, but it feels like it's not going to capture the sensitivity to variations in space in the super oscillatory regime, because you know it's
yes, that's right.
The correlation is going to have a very high. So it seems like the protocols that make this connection are, it's kind of in an asymptotic. If you have many copies and you try to figure out for many copies, but this is more like if somehow I can post-select on the best possible result, then the translational asymmetry is not given by some notion of the width and momentum space, but this instead.
Yes.
And so I guess all I'm saying is that I think that maybe taking the resource theory of asymmetry angle on this stuff might also yield some interesting insights because, it's just a different perspective from the one you have.
Very interesting. Is that related to the interpretation of the time energy uncertainty principle?
It is, yeah. So you reconceive the time energy uncertainty.
Exactly.
It's momentum, you can,
how long do you have to wait until the overlap is perceptible, right?
Yeah, you can think of the spread in energy as a measure of time translation non-invariant.
Exactly.
And similarly with your sort of spread in time. It's just a comment, really, that might be another way of useful perspective on it.
Yeah, it might be translatable into some strange statement about quantum clocks. Yeah, nice.
Okay, well, so that's what I said. Thank you.